Hey everyone, welcome back to the 443 Security Simplified. I'm your host, Mark LaLiberty, and joining me today is...
Corey
Black Unicorn
Knockgrinder.
Black Unicorn Knockgrinder. Okay. In today's episode, we have another big news roundup. It's been a very busy day with some rather hot topics that are even applicable to non-technical folks. Anyone that uses social media probably heard of our first... Yes, including you. Anyone who's using social media has probably heard of our first topic we'll bring up. So with that, let's go ahead and jump on in. So we have had another very busy news week again this week. Quite a few topics to bring up. We'll see if we can cram all of them into this particular episode. So with that, let's jump in with what is possibly the hottest topic on all of social media over the last few weeks. It actually starts with an app that was developed actually a few years ago now by a small team out of St. Petersburg, Russia, called FaceApp. And if you are living under a rock or you followed our advice and deleted Facebook, you might not have heard of it, but it uses...
They would still see it on Instagram or the news or every freaking morning talk show that ever existed.
Long story short, this app uses an AI neural network to modify photos to keep them photorealistic while making modifications. Like some of their examples are adding a smiley face, adding makeup, or what's really been taking off over the last few weeks, maybe making people age something like 40 years.
Yeah, apparently a lot of celebrities have done it.
Russell Wilson did.
Speaking of, this isn't the first time this app is in the news. It's been around forever. And I think sometime 2 years ago, 2017, didn't they do a gender swap, but more importantly, a race swap, where you could change your race? And that got a little bit of attention. Yeah.
It's making its rounds in the news again, though, because... I want to think because of all the recent celebrity attention, a lot of people have been using it again. And because a lot of people have been using it, people have been looking into who developed it,
where this information's going. Like you, man. Because I don't know, an old person doesn't want to know how old they're going to look when they're already looking old.
My dad said the exact same thing over dinner the other day.
Now I sound like Mark's dad.
He said,
that's really going to help my old grumpy guy image.
He said something like, I don't need to use this app. I can just look in a mirror. But you are correct. The millennials have been loving this app. I guess we can throw Russell Wilson in with him. He's a millennial, right?
He might be closer than me. No, he's still younger than me, though.
He's a youngin'. Is he 30? Interesting. Well, anyways, because this app's been like all over social media recently, it's brought up quite a few privacy concerns as people have pointed out some of the verbiage in their terms of service and the fact that the developers are in Russia. So
their EULA is horrible. I mean, not that any EULA is good, which I'm sure we'll talk about, but some of the verbiage they use in their EULA is pretty crazy.
By giving them your picture, you grant them a license, a perpetual, irrevocable, non-exclusive, royalty-free, worldwide, transferable license to all uploaded photos. Basically, they can use your photo for whatever they want after the fact.
Yep.
Now, they do say that even though they are a Russian-based development firm, the uploads, as they upload it into the cloud to do all their AI processing, all takes place outside of Russia. They're using AWS and Google Cloud infrastructure for this. And they do claim, even with that EULA, they don't sell or share any of your user data to third parties.
They even claim that for most images, they're gone from their own cloud within 48 hours.
Mm-hmm. But it does bring up so nothing is free. So how are they making money off of this if it's all this infrastructure to do this AI processing?
Well, I don't know if you've looked at the app. I actually haven't loaded it, but it does have payments. You can pay for different versions of the app to get filters. So I know where you were going. Nothing in life is free. And we often mention that if you don't know how an app is making money, it's probably because you're the product and it's your data. And there could be some of that. The EULA definitely allows for that. Whatever they say, they could be lying about not using it, but they do have micro payments within the app, okay, so they could monetize that way.
I have not used the app because I'm the world's biggest tinfoil hat privacy
nerd. Haven't even touched it myself, even though it would be interesting to see how I would look even older.
So one of our researchers on our team actually brought up the idea that, so we've been looking to try and get a collection of faces for some research we're doing. And this would be the perfect way of doing it if you wanted to get a collection of people's faces. Make a fun little app out of it where, oh, look, now you look old. And by the way, thank you for your face. We're going to use it for our research.
So you can go both ways on this, Mark. And I, you know, on one hand, I love that this app has people thinking about their privacy. And I get that it's made in Russia, which is scary, and it's why apparently the Democrats are asking the FBI to investigate. But I honestly kind of think this particular app, it's being overblown. And if you really wanted to think about it, every social media app out there has this similar to almost the same EULA. Facebook has unrevocable royalty-free access to your photos that they can use in their advertisement. They might have changed some of that a little recently because they've been under a little pressure, but Instagram, Snapchat, it's all the same. So is it really the Russia that has people all stirred up? That's true. That's a possibility. You know, even if this company is fully good faith, if they live in a country where their government can do their form of subpoena, this would be a great way to feed a image recognition database to do facial recognition and scanning, especially if they can attach your name to it. But there's a bazillion, emphasizing it, but there's at least hundreds, if not thousands, of apps that you're uploading pictures to every day that you're giving away the same privacy and can be used in all the same ways.
You do point out the extremely ironic fact that people are complaining about this app on Facebook.
On Facebook. Yeah. Come on, guys. The one where you have your profile picture?
Yes. So the tinfoil hat me says, be wary of it. I understand it's still it's a fun little app. And I mean, like you said, your picture, if you use social media, all that's already out there anyway. So
there is one big, I mean, we didn't go into a lot of the data that this app, like some of the data claims have been overstated. Some people have claimed it's your whole photo. It's not, it's literally only the stuff you upload. One person complained in iOS, I didn't give it access to my photo library, but it still let me upload a photo, so it's bypassing it. That's actually not true. It's a function of iOS that even if you don't give it to your library, you still can individually allow one picture at a time. So by you picking a picture, you're telling iOS to allow it.
Which makes sense.
Yeah. But it can have your name, your email address, and your username on the app, and it can possibly have the metadata in the pictures. A lot of people don't think about that. You know, the average phone picture nowadays has a GPS location, has the name of your camera, has some other data that's identifying. So you should think about that. But as we've been saying, every picture is pretty much similar. But the one tip is, you know, I'm not sure if I'd recommend you go use this. Like me and Mark are a little tinfoil hattie and we wouldn't. But if you do, know that you do not have to log in. You do not have to sign up and create an account. And if you don't do that, you can still upload a picture, but they won't have your name and email. So they at least can't identify that picture to a person.
At least until they use that picture with another facial recognition
which
database.
Has your name. Yeah. Although if you think they're trying to feed the names to go with the images, that, you know, that's what the Russian government needs.
Maybe
they need a database with our names and images. If they only have our images, they still need that other piece somewhere.
Could just be attempting to build an update for the Zuckerbot. Who knows? So our next news story also revolves around AI and machine learning. Corey, you want to introduce this one?
Sure. Although I would argue that the Face app, other than the fact that it uses AI, the privacy issue had nothing to do with
AI. We got to hit our buzzwords, dang it.
Okay. AI, IoT, we're going to be talking about IoT today.
Yep.
Don't forget about SDN, software-defined whatever, software-defined everything.
Sponsored by cryptocurrency.
And blockchain. Can't forget blockchain when we're talking. So this story actually affects one of our partners in a pretty cool product, but you might have heard of a company called Cylance. They make a number of products out there that use their Protect engine. It's a artificial intelligence or machine learning-based engine that can catch malware. You know, you've probably heard us talk about this. They've taken millions and millions, if not billions, of both good file and bad file or malware samples and use that to train kind of this algorithm to help them catch new malware as it comes out. Well, researchers, I believe they were in Australia, right? Some researchers in Australia who go by the name of Skylight Cyber found an interesting way to bypass the endpoint-based Cylance engine. And it was kind of interesting. So I don't think these particular researchers have insight into everything Cylance is doing. But what they essentially found that if they take known malware samples like WannaCry or Mimikatz, which we see a lot in our internet security report, Cylance is really good at catching those plain Jane samples. But by doing some analysis, they found that there was a particular game executable. The game currently is still unnamed until Cylance fixes this, where they just did a strings command. So if you're not technical, strings will take a binary file, which is usually machine code, but often there's some ASCII strings contained in that file, and it will show you all the ASCII strings within a file. So they take the strings of this particular game executable, and they basically just append it to the malware. And once they did that, Cylance no longer recognized WannaCry or Mimikatz or some of the other samples they used as malware. So an interesting way to bypass. According to the blog post, they're kind of making presumptions. They don't see inside the engine. So they're presuming that perhaps Cylance uses some sort of whitelist. You know, if you're using machine learning to identify malicious files, there may be a case where occasionally there's a good file that you identify as bad, so maybe there's some capability for whitelisting. And the researchers are presuming that's the reason that Cylance is missing this. Maybe it had a whitelist for this particular game, and by adding the strings to a piece of malware file, you'll get past it. So that's essentially the story. I don't know if the whitelist part is true. We're partners with Cylance. Cylance has responded to this, by the way. They have a blog post on it. They admit that it is an issue, but they're fixing it pretty quickly. I think they'll have a fix coming out, sometime next week, it sounds like.
Yep. And, I mean, this points out it's pretty similar to some other research we've seen with AI in the past as well. Like you've mentioned a few times on this podcast, I think it was one of Google's researchers where they're doing image recognition. If you put a sticker on it, it suddenly changes it into a banana.
So when you first hear that an AI engine like Cylance is bypassed, if you're a nerd, you immediately think, oh, they use some sort of fancy adversarial machine learning. And this is literally taking another machine learning algorithm and giving it kind of the outputs of the real machine learning algorithm kind of learn how it's figuring out what to consider as good or bad. I don't believe that these researchers really used that in this research. They used some analytics to figure out what game to get down to, it sounds like. Mm-hmm. But they didn't need to use any sort of adversarial machine learning to figure out some feature they could add to their malware to get past this. But that is what I presumed when I first saw these headlines. Yeah.
And I think this is a really good opportunity to talk about, again, the importance of like multi-layer security, where there's no single security product that is 100% effective 100% of the time.
Yeah.
Eventually, something will get by it, whether it be by appending strings or maybe obfuscating code or using a zero day, which is why you need other layers to back up the security of your systems too.
Absolutely. It's why at WatchGuard for our boxes, if you have our total security package, we have something I like to call anyways, our advanced anti-malware pipeline. There's like literally four different technologies we use to find malware. The first is kind of traditional gateway antivirus, which heavily uses signatures. There's some other stuff there, heuristics and basic code emulation, but it's mostly signature-based. Then we have Cylance, and Cylance does come next because it does do a very good job at catching a lot of the malware signatures miss. But as you said, every security control will have imperfections. They'll get fixed, but then new imperfections will be found. And that's why right after Cylance, we use our APT blocker product, which uses behavioral analysis. You know, if we haven't seen a file before, we'll literally run it in the sandbox and see what it does. And for the fourth, by the way, we know even with those three layers, that's some pretty strong anti-malware. If you can get past all three of those layers, wow, you've done something
Kudos.
Right as a threat actor. But even in that case, we still have a final product called TDR, threat detection and response, we shorten it to TDR. And that actually is an agent that runs on the endpoint. And it's not like AV to block malware from the endpoint. Rather, it's doing a lot of of different things on the endpoint, from process behavioral analysis to something called dynamic heuristics, where we're paying attention to, or both static and dynamic heuristics. But for dynamic, we're looking at some of the things a process is doing, or some characteristics of running processes. And by doing that, even if malware gets onto the endpoint, once it runs, we still have a chance to catch and stop it. So really, that's why the layered security message, you know, as boring as defense in depth sounds to security people have been citing it for literally decades, it still is what wins the day.
Yep. So expect an update from Cylance probably sometime very soon after this podcast drops.
And I will say, by the way, for WatchGuard users, that this does affect all their engines, including the engine we use of theirs. So it theoretically affects us as well. But again, that's why if you have APT blocker and other things, I wouldn't be overly concerned about it. We will have a fix as soon as it's available.
Yep. Just make sure you have all your checkboxes checked and you're looking for updates.
Meanwhile, what game do you think it is?
I'm betting World of Warcraft.
Fortnite probably is another one, right?
Fortnite.
Some sort of really popular game that was triggering some
Fortnite,
issues.
I bet. You know, that's exactly what those reasons. They were probably playing Fortnite and they're like, oh, wait a minute. Maybe this, like, yeah, let's give that a, oh, hey, look. Who knows? I am sure we'll find out as soon as it's patched, and that'll be another interesting news story when that hits too.
I will say kudos to the researchers. The reason they're holding back the game, if you didn't figure it out, is they don't want bad guys to be able to recreate this till it's fixed. And if you read the actual blog post on this, it has it's kind of a silly name. They say, Cylance, I kill you. But if you actually read the blog post, they actually are very positive on Cylance and say it does a very good job at catching new malware.
Good. So let's move on to news story number 3 now for the week. This actually comes from some research last week from Symantec, where they found yet another app on the Google Play Store that, in this case, it advertised itself as an unofficial version of the Telegram messaging app. But this app, while it used open source code from the legitimate Telegram app, came injected with malware that loads up malicious URLs in the background. So we already hit on Android malware, I think, in our last podcast specifically, and how it seems like there's been a lot of focus on this lately. I still really think this is the next frontier when it comes to malware. We use our mobile devices so much.
Oh, absolutely.
So it makes sense that the bad guys are really starting to target this. And it's interesting that we continue to find malicious applications on the supposedly safe and curated Google Play Store.
Yeah, so the one thing, I don't like fanboyism. I think all companies have problems, but I do feel like Apple's vetting is better than Google Play's vetting. Now, both these app stores have vetting. One is a much more closed vetting process, and by extent, I think they're closing it more for commercial reasons. They don't want to be secure. Apple gives a crap about money, and they're probably being very picky because they really want to control their apps. Meanwhile, Google, as you know, they're very open. They like many devs. They encourage experimental stuff on the App Store. Both of them have vetting. I believe Google's is very automated. It's code-based vetting, which is great. But humans always can find more issues than code. Apple, I think, sometimes literally has people involved more for the business side of things in the process. So I wonder if that's why more tends to show up in Google Play. Not that Apple is perfect, by the way. Plenty has got through there. But it seems like Google Play keeps on getting sometimes hundreds at a time of apps that we found some sort of malware or ad kits or things like that.
Corey doesn't like fanboying as he sits behind his MacBook Pro with his iWatch and his iPhone in his pocket.
Kind of looking at your MacBook Pro. Granted, I guess you are Android on the phone side.
Yes.
So.
But you do bring up a good point that it seems like Google, I don't know the details, but it seems like they do rely more on like tech and bots to go look through these apps, which some researchers have pointed out that like even just encrypting your malicious code can help get it past the vetting process that Google has.
Now, I bet there's plenty of things that could even get past human vetters, especially if, you know, there's still quite a bit of volume, I'm sure, of new software on Apple Store. So maybe this is more a fact that Android's such an open platform. It's just much easier for a bad guy that's new to coding to figure out ways to create Android packages than it is to kind of figure out Apple's SDK and iOS crap.
And I feel like we've already beat our recommendation into the ground of not sideloading applications, but yep. This is a case where it wasn't sideloaded. It was available on the official Google Play Store, but it was still, I mean, in my opinion, a fishy app. Don't use an unofficial version of
Telegram.
Telegram.
Usually, and by the way, this is where, I still think the use official stores is a good, because just by pure numbers, you're much less likely to get malware on Google Play, even though it happens. But the secondary thing, besides knowing if you're downloading something from the iOS App Store or Google Play, look at reviews. I mean, use some crowdsourcing. Usually these crappy or fishy apps have a 1-star and will even have comments that I got ads or it redirected me to a different search server. So pay attention to things as simple as people's reviews, not just to see if you want the app, but to see what they say about security.
And there's even, I've seen instances of malicious apps that they do have reviews and they have good reviews, but they're all quite obviously fake. Look at the recency of the reviews, if they all came
English.
In the last day. Grammar is good. Make sure, check the amount of reviews. Good apps that have been there for a while will have thousands, if not millions, of reviews. Whereas these crappy ones that just pop up, probably significantly less.
There's two telegrams. It's probably relatively easy to figure it out which one, just based by the number of comments.
Yep. I think in this case, it did even have a different name. I think it was Monogram or something like that. So the name should give it away too. But if you are an Android dude, and I guess even an iOS dude, just be wary of installing these unofficial apps, because there is a little bit of a risk that comes with it.
I think, I'm kind of a person that likes trying things, but I think there might be something said for not trying every free and stupid app. I mean, do we really need, 99 apps on our phone? Maybe think about whether or not you really need the next, puzzle game or whatever.
I'll let you know what I can fit 99 apps on my phone without it crashing.
But do definitely get the new Harry Potter game.
Oh, yes, of course. Everyone's here having fun on Friday night, and I'm just catching unicorns in my Harry Potter game.
Yes.
We have one more final news story to bring up. This one requires a little bit of explanation and lead up into it, I think. So to start out with, phishing, I feel like we talk about all the time.
You don't want to just throw out acronyms and talk about SPF and DKIM and DMARC?
No.
Come on, I'm sure everyone gets it.
Yes, actually, yeah, SPF, DKIM, DMARC.
I barely know if I get it.
So we talk about phishing a lot. It's obviously a really big issue. Trend Micro did some recent study, and it was 91% of all cyber attacks start with phishing
emails. Or targeted, for sure,
yes.
Right? And even most malware starts with phishes.
And one of the ways that these phishing emails gain a lot of their credibility is the bad guys will spoof the sender address in the email to appear like it comes from a trusted employee. We've seen plenty of instances where we receive an email from Prakash Panjwani where it's not really Prakash that sent it. And there are actually several standards out there that can help detect and prevent these spoofed emails. And there's three that we're going to go over here. This research kind of goes on to the third one. The first standard is the older one. This one's called SPF, or Sender Policy Framework. And really, it just allows an organization to publicly identify what servers are allowed to be sources for their emails. So if you are checking SPF records and you receive an email from mark@watchguard.com, you can check and see which server IP addresses are allowed to send emails for watchguard.com. And if it matches up, it passes. The problem with SPF, though, is that it actually only protects the envelope from address. So if you're not a super email nerd, the from address actually shows up in a few different locations in the actual message itself. There's this thing called the envelope, which is really what the servers use to communicate with each other. And then there's headers, which is what your email client uses to display in Outlook. So the envelope from address can actually be different from the header from that you see in Outlook or whatever your mail client is. And SPF protects the envelope side, so it helps the servers. If you're just using SPF, it's still possible to spoof the header, which means when you open up that message in Outlook or Thunderbird or whatever your client is, it could still say it's from Prakash Panjwani quite easily. And that's kind of where the technology number two comes in, which is DKIM, or Domain Keys Identified Mail. And this one uses public key cryptography to authenticate message envelope information, where there's an additional header that goes in. You have a special DNS record with your public key published out there. And with the DKIM information in the headers, You can say, I've protected these headers. Here's an authenticated cryptographic hash of it. If any of those headers get modified in any way, or if they're not using the right key, which only I have access to, you can mark this message as invalid.
And it's domain-based, right? It's like, Prakash obviously works at WatchGuard, so for him to send email from WatchGuard, he should be coming with the right keys. So,
exactly.
You know, someone might still be able to put Prakash Panjwani in the header, but it wouldn't be from the real WatchGuard domain if this is working.
And you can see evidence in this. I know in Gmail, if you open up a message from like eBay or PayPal or something, there will be a little lock by the from field. And that just means that Gmail was able to validate the domain key used to sign those headers. And so this protects you by a bad guy can't go in there and just spoof the from header because they would need access to your private key in order to then authenticate that. With that said, it is possible for the attacker to set up a third-party fictitious domain, set up a valid DKIM record for that, still spoof the from header, but then sign it using his other third domain.
So to give an example, you would still want to look for emails from Prakash Panjwani at vv.ochgard instead of the W. So still look out for tricks where someone's making something look like your domain, but it isn't literally your domain.
So that's a little weakness in DKIM. The third standard that comes up, though, kind of solves almost both of those problems, and this one's DMARC. Or domain-based message authentication, reporting, and conformance.
Oh, that's an acronym. That's just so easy to remember. All those words, they'll come straight to my mind.
It's super easy for me to remember because it's my name.
Mark. Because Mark stands for message authentication, reporting, and conformance.
That's what my parents said when I was born.
I always knew you conformed.
I'm not a conformist. So DMARC actually allows domain owners to specify whether their messages should be protected by SPF and or DKIM through another domain record, hence the domain-based. And also, it provides instructions to the receiver of messages on what to do for any given domain if they receive a message that doesn't pass SPF or DKIM. So you can set up a DMARC record that says, if you receive an email from WatchGuard.com and it doesn't pass SPF or DKIM, send us a report saying, hey, we got this spoofed thing and also rejected.
I think we should just say, hack back the person that sent it immediately. That sending server. I'm sure that's legal, right?
I mean, I think the flags are like pass, quarantine, reject, and hack back.
So. Yeah.
But the cool thing about DMARC is it has this concept of alignment where it actually checks both the header from matches with the envelope from or with the DKIM domain. So that it kind of closes up the loop with the flaws in both SPF and DKIM to make it a little bit better to catch these spoofed domains. And long story short with all this, an email analytics company called 250OK, which I think is actually funny because OK is the response code 250 for email messages.
Anyone that's, by the way, tried to telnet into an email server to do this sort of spoofing, as I'm sure everyone listening has, you're very aware of the 250OK.
Yep. So the company,
although usually it has the real email server credentials, or I'm sorry, the
domain
server. No, I actually mean literally sometimes Exchange version, whatever.
Oh, right.
Too, unless you have a WatchGuard Firebox and a beautiful proxy to hide that sort of information.
Exactly, security by obscurity.
Yep.
The WatchGuard way.
No, but a little obscurity on top of real security does help.
It is useful protecting against reconnaissance. But anyways, this research by 250OK just released their global DMARC adoption report. And they found that only—
Everyone does it, right? Everyone.
Spoiler alert, no. Only 20.3% of domains have a published DMARC policy, period. And only 6.1% of domains have a reject policy.
Like so even if they have it, a few actually pay any intent, they still accept email that doesn't pass.
Exactly. So— DMARC, it sounds like a little complex topic, but it's actually, in general, really easy to set up. Like DMARC.org has a whole bunch of guides on setting it up depending on what mail server you're using. Just about everyone under the face of the sun these days uses Office 365 with hosted email, and it is insanely simple to set up in there. It's under the Admin Center domain settings. You can just add a DMARC record for your domain.
By the way, DMARC is the only acronym you have to remember because by definition, to get DMARC set up, you'll have to go through the other two things too.
Yep. And all these guys, they will walk you through setting up SPF records, walk you through setting up DKIM. And most mail clients and servers will help sign all that stuff and validate it on their own too.
So non-technical takeaway, remember DMARC, Google how to use it, do it once, and then forget all the acronyms.
Exactly. And that can help protect you against people saying, I am Prakash Panjwani,
from
go buy 10 gift cards and bring them into the office.
Yeah. Or can you do a wire transfer to one of our partners for $20,000?
Exactly. So we'll have to, I'm going to wait for next year and we'll see if they release another DMARC adoption report and see if it goes up anymore. I'm willing to bet it's not going to go up the whole time.
Oh, you're so wrong. Everyone here is listening to the 443. I bet we'll get it at least up to 90% with our global audience.
I'm still waiting for BGP route origin validation to take off
too.
That's
true.
But that's going to be even longer.
Or BCP38, anti-spoofing from networks.
Yes. So if you do manage your own email domain, look into adding SPF, DKIM, DMARC records. Like it might take you like a day to go learn about them and add them, but it'll be so much worth it to help protect you and the people you work with from people spoofing your own domain.
And by the way, to protect other users too. I mean, the benefit to someone like WatchGuard doing that is emails going to other companies, as long as their server's set to look at DMARC, you won't be spoofed by a email that's coming from Prakash Panjwani, even if you're not part of the WatchGuard company.
Exactly. So I think that rounds up our news for the day. And with that, party time.
Beer's on me.
Oh, you heard it here. Thanks again for listening, everyone. As always, if you enjoyed today's episode, don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe. Has Google added reviewing yet?
I don't know. Who uses Google? There's too many malicious apps on that Play Store.
If you have any questions on today's topics or suggestions for future episode topics, don't be afraid to reach out to us on Twitter. I'm at @XORRO_. Corey is @SecAdept, and the both of us are @#the443podcast. Thanks again for listening, and we will see you next week.
You could say that in your sleep.
I do.